How would you like to unlock employee engagement and motivation? Steve Jones will tell us how to do this. And what's so special about Steve Jones is he's a global leadership strategist, business coach, speaker, and author who specializes in unlocking leadership potential, accelerating business growth, and transforming team performance. And he has decades of hands-on experience, and that's why we're so delighted to hear about how can entrepreneurs unlock employee engagement and motivation in their teams. Heal Podcast with Lily Patrascu shares longevity and anti-aging techniques to stay young forever, increase energy, overcome addiction, and live your longest, best life ever, shared by world's most innovative alternative and traditional health thought leaders, healers, and doctors. Discover quantum healing strategies to heal your mind, body, and soul.
Okay, well, you want me to start by answering that?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, well, lovely to meet you, Lily, and your audience. So basically, yes, I look at motivation, first of all. So if I give you my background, then you'll understand. So I do my background, they'll understand why I do what I do and how I do what I do. And then we could go in from there, if you like.
Sure.
Would that be? Yeah, yeah. So my background was health and fitness management. So I was with Fitness First PLC when we started with one club in the UK. I left when we were the largest in the world. We did it in 7 years. We went through the AIM, the full listing, opening a club a week at 1.2 worldwide. So I experienced fast growth and all its nightmares and all its glories. And I left in about 2001 when the city got hold of it. And it made no sense to me at all. I became that demotivated employee that we talk about. So and then I spent some time just chilling, really just getting over having work exhaustion. And then I started to help a few companies with their growth. And then I got approached by an international coaching organization called Sherlaws, who specialized in fast growth. They were an Australian outfit coming to the UK. I spent 3 years with them, working with their methodologies, tools, and techniques, which mapped perfectly my Fitness First journey. So that was great. But I noticed when I got into about the year three that there was a bit missing for me. And I thought, if you're going to grow a company, you need to actually attract and keep talent and get the leadership right. And they don't think they were really covering that as well as I'd liked. So I stepped away, started to look at motivational leadership issues in organizations. And whilst I was doing that, I got approached by the government task force team in the UK that were looking at employee engagement because it was so poor. Only one in three people going to work were engaged. So I spent 3 years co-chairing the steering committee, and we looked at what they were getting right and what they were getting wrong. And we found four main themes, which I'll talk about in a minute, that separated companies that were getting it right from getting it wrong. So I stepped away, built my skills of business to address these issues. And then I had a really good success with clients. So I got commissioned to write a book called Mapping Motivation for Engagement, which is all about how I transformed these two organizations overnight over about a year. So that was good. And that's pretty much what I do now. I work with organizations to help them manage fast growth, keep their talent and get their leadership right. So the way that I do this is interesting because there were four main themes that came out of the task force where we looked at companies that are getting it right rather than getting it wrong. And I split that up into about eight different things, and I created a wheel of engagement. So when I work with companies, we just get them to spend 2 minutes completing this wheel. It then helps them understand where they need to put their focus. So I'm going to talk you through the wheel. So the first thing is you need a strategic narrative. When I talk about strategic narrative, what I mean is you need a clear understanding of where the company's come, where it's been, where it is now, and where it's going in the future. Now, lots of companies have great stories, but they simply don't tell them. They talk about what they do and how they do it, but they don't talk about why they do what they do. Now, the why is really important when you're trying to attract talent, because if someone joins your organization for what you do and how you do it, probably they're joining for a job. If they join for the why you do what you do, they're joining because they can. There's a bit of passion behind it. So we need to understand where they come from, where they are now, where they're going in the future. And I encourage MDs to actually video themselves talking about their journey, especially the founders, so you can put it into appraisal processes, and it happens all the time. The second thing is once you've got your vision clear, once you've got your sort of story clear about where you've come from, where you are now, and where you're going, we then start to look at, well, let's design a 3-year vision. So if someone joins an organization, they're going to want to know where the company's headed and how they fit. So having a three-year vision is really important. Now, that three-year vision quite often just stays with the leadership team. The rest of the business don't know it. The leadership team do. So the next part is we need to communicate it. We need to understand. Everybody in the business understands the story and the vision. It's on our website. Our customers know it. Every employee knows it. So that's the story and the vision is told. And then we move to engaging managers. So that's the second area. And engaging managers means most people end up in a managerial or leadership role by default. They typically don't have the training. They've moved from technician to leading and managing, and then they sink or swim based on past experiences. So it's really important that you get your leaders and managers trained in the skill sets to be leaders and managers. And I'll tell you why, because people don't quit their jobs, they quit their bosses. And if you haven't got good leadership across your organization, it's a challenge. So that's the next thing we look at. So have you got good leaders and good managers? And then dovetailing into that is you need management by walking around. So you need managers that know how to motivate staff and how to engage staff and how to get the best out of people. So there needs to be management by walking around, but understanding what motivates people. And we'll talk about motivation in a bit more detail in a minute. So once you've done that, the next thing is you need to make sure you have a listening voice in your organization. So there's the ability for people who join you to contribute to the success of the business. Now, what I mean by this is best explained by what Richard Branson does. Richard Branson will tell you he recruits people so they can tell him what to do. But I see a lot of companies that recruit very good talent and then just dictate to it. So they're not getting the best from their people. So how do you listen to your staff is the next thing we look at. And then we come to the final area, which is actually your strategic narrative. Which we go strategic narrative. We've gone engaging managers, and now we've gone employee voice, and now we're looking at the values of the organization. So when we talk about values, most companies have a set of values, but if you ask what they are, they've got to scamper around and find them. And they certainly don't live and breathe them. So what we want there is companies that live and breathe them. So they need to be part of your appraisal process. You need to catch people in the moment living them. And if they're not, there need to be consequences and rewards. So you bring those values to life. So those were the eight things, the four things distilled into eight areas that I identified that companies needed to work on. And I built a motivational leadership process, operating process to deal with that. And that's what I sell to organizations now. How do we get you to become an employer brand and employer choice and have managers that lead and manage well and staff that want to be there? So that's kind of it in a nutshell. I hope I haven't spoken for too long about that, but that's where we are basically.
Tell me what needs to happen on a personal level to be able to unlock employee engagement and motivation. The reason I ask you this is I remember one of the first companies that I started kind of leading. I remember that when I started, I didn't know how to open Word. Okay. And I was what you might call an incompetent leader. And I really didn't know much about the business. And I was, I was triggering people with my presence. Okay. So I'm wondering what needs to happen on a personal level as the founder of a company like this, where let's say you want to unlock employee engagement and motivation. What do you as a person need to do to be able to do all of this?
Okay. Great question. And it happens a lot. People come into roles. So let's just look at the leadership element first of all. But I think you have to get the recruitment right in the first place. You have to recruit people that want to work for the organization, not looking for a job. So first of all, we'll talk about motivation in a minute, but you need to get the right motivations in. But once someone's joined, like when you joined, what should have happened and what probably didn't happen was they need to give you a really good induction process. So you understand the organization, why it exists and where you fit. And then they need to direct you. They need to give you a period where they train you. They train you in the skills you require to do the job and make sure you've got the skills. So let me liken this to driving a car, because everybody has driven a car or has been in a car. So when you get in the instructor's car for the first time, he's going to show you around the car and he's going to show you everything. And that's what we call directing. So he's teaching you the car, basically. But you'll notice that after three or four lessons, You're driving along and suddenly he says, we're coming to a junction. What do you need to do? He's now moved to coaching. He's now asking you what you think you should do. So in your terms, when you join an organization, 3 months learning the job, then we move to coaching. I'm not going to tell you anymore. You should know. I'm going to start asking you to think for yourself. That's the coaching. And then you're getting pretty good at driving the car and you're getting close to your test. So now he's going to mentor you. A mentor means you're coming up for your test. This is what the instructor is going to do. Here's the things I couldn't tell you on day one that you can absorb now because you're further down the journey. And then you're going to take your test and then you're going to be able to drive the car. And that's the journey an employee goes through. So we need to tell you what to do. Then we need to ask you to challenge you to think for yourself. And then we need to fine tune and give you some wisdom. And then you're going to be as good or better than me. So I just need to orchestrate you.
Thank you. Now, imagine someone who is actually the founder of an organization with 10 people or 100 people. What do they need to do so they don't trigger people and instead they enroll, touch, move, and inspire people to work for him or her?
Okay, so there's a couple of things there. Let me just talk about the entrepreneurial journey, first of all. So most founders start because they have a passion and they're technically brilliant and they drive the whole business. But they come to a point when you get, I think it's about 55 million turnover potentially, where actually that's going to fail them because they are the pinch point in the business. They are the bottleneck. All the decisions go through them. So they have to change their mindset and they have to become a business owner and they have to build leadership teams. And those leadership teams have to function to run the business. And also you need systems and processes in order to scale. So they have to change. That's the first thing. The second thing is you need to know your people, to your point. So you need to understand what drives and motivates them. And there's 9 work motivators. And each of these motivations requires you to manage that person in a different, slightly different way in order to get the maximum out of them. Now, I can take you through those 9 work motivators.
Yes.
If you wish.
Yes. So the motivators for people that may work for you.
Yeah. So let's look at that next. So let me make the distinction first. This is not personality. Personality is your behaviors at work. So it pretty much if you did a Myers-Briggs Insights Color Works, it's going to be pretty much the same. If you do it again, motivation is dynamic and changeable. So let's go with the 9 motivations. So the first motivation is defender. So a defender likes security and they like predictability. They don't like a lot of change. So if you're managing that individual, you would have to think about making them feel secure, no surprises, and probably don't talk about change, talk about improvement, because they don't like a lot of change and they dig their heels in. So you need to manage them in a different way. Then the second motivator is friend. So friend, they like a community of people. They like to be amongst all the staff. They like to chat about social stuff and they're social animals. So, you know, if you're going to put them in an office on their own, you're going to fail them because they're going to be isolated. If you've got a hot desk in your organization, they're going to be isolated. If you're going to hybrid and send them home to work, they're going to be isolated. So you need to make sure they've got a community. And as a manager or a leader or a founder, you need to spend some time, just some social time with them, which is important. And to other people, it may not be, but to them it is. So that's the friend. And then we have the star. The star likes to peacock and shine. They like to be on TV. They like to, you know, they like to be recognized. So these people like awards, they like to get recognition. So you've got to be aware that in the UK, this is quite a low motivation. A lot of people get put off by these people, but they make good ambassadors for the business. They're good at marketing. So make sure they can shine in the organization. So they're the first three. The second three, you've got the director. So the director needs power, control, influence. So they like to be in control. Now, the danger is they could be micromanagers. They could like control without the skill, but they typically want to be in control. So if you've got a business that's fast growing, in actual fact, these people are really good because they'll grab responsibility. They like to be in charge. So to motivate them, give them more responsibility. It's quite simple. Okay. The next person is the builder. Now, the builder likes material satisfaction above average standard of living. So what they're looking for out of life is they want the rewards they want. So they make good salespeople because they work. They like bonuses. They like being well paid. They like commercial environments where they can sell. So they're the people who are the commercial people. So they're driven by opportunities to make money for the business or for themselves. Then we have the expert. The expert loves to learn, develop, and grow. When Richard Branson started his business, he had a lot of experts around them. He didn't have to pay them much because they loved learning and developing and growing. So these people want the opportunity to demonstrate their expertise, but also be experts at what they do. So they make good mentors for other people, and they make, you know, training courses motivate them. So give them lots of opportunities to learn, develop, and grow on the org. Then we come to the final three, which are more entrepreneurial. You have the creator. Now, the creator loves to innovate, every day being different. So they like variety and change. They like projects. They like taking risk. They like new ideas. They're quite fast-paced. They don't like the defender because the defender's slow and doesn't like change. So they love innovation. So you've got to reward them with vibrant environments where they can think. And so development teams, that kind of stuff would be perfect for them. Then you have the spirit. The spirit loves freedom and autonomy. So this individual likes to do their own thing. So they like to work on their own. They're so often described as maverick. They want to do their own thing. So if you're managing that one, just give them clear, concise instructions and leave them alone. But have a reporting process. Let them get on with it themselves. And then the final one is searcher. So the searcher, they love to make a difference. So they're purpose maximizers. So they have to have meaning in what they do in their work. They need feedback. They're doing a good job. So those are the nine motivations. And the diagnostic that I use with clients identifies that it rank makes it forces them to rank them all. And then we can work out if these are your top three, which are the ones we work with, how much of that is your employer allowing you to express in the organization. And we have a scoring system so we can work out how motivated they are and what the company needs to do to harness these motivations in the workplace. So that's a really powerful tool for a manager or a leader or a founder to know about people, because then he knows how to approach them, how to get the best out of them, and how to get out of their way so they can succeed. Does that make sense?
Yes. Do you find that some people are actually a mix of multiple motivating factors? For example, I see myself in the director, in the spirit, in the conscious person that is looking for meaning. And there is one that the creator mostly. Yeah. And also there is in this, you know, in the person that likes to work independently. And also there is one that I'm not sure is expressed, which is I like to make sure that actually my work mattered, like I made a difference. So even, for example, even if I wasn't paid, I like to know that the thing that I did made a massive difference to the employer in terms of the bottom line, in terms of like the productivity, like more sales, and like what I got paid is like really like last on the list, even though like I like sales and I find it exciting to kind of like say, okay, I can live in this amazing thing or whatever, but knowing that I made a difference, that's the thing that matters the most. So do you find that there are people that have multiple motivators that activate them, like their motivation?
So we look at all nine motivations, and some people have a mix of them. Some people have very few that really drive them, and some people have a range that drive them. So you've described four or so, maybe five there that drive you. So we'd look at the intensities of your scorings around those. So there'll be a three main ones, and then there'll be some others that sit just underneath it. And we'd have to look at that. And to describe making a difference, that's the searcher. So I need to know my work adds value. That's the searcher. But when you were talking, you combined it with the builder, so it has a commercial return. So the searcher, pure searcher, needs to know what they're doing is adding value, regardless of money. Am I, you know, is what I'm getting out of bed for purposeful and meaningful? And am I getting the feedback that I'm doing the right thing? And quite often in organizations, you know this yourself, we get told when we're not doing things well, not when we're doing things well. So it's kind of counterproductive. So we know we need to feed. And people who have searcher profile need to know the bigger picture of the organization so they can see how they can add value. So we've got intensities and motivations. All of these, we have all of these motivations in some degree with us, but there are dominant ones and there are ones that we are not like. And the one, if I didn't say it, but when I was going through those, the one that didn't resonate with you, the one which is your lowest, is the one that you'll have a challenge with. So in the UK, quite often star is the lowest. So we don't like people who peacock and shine and shout about themselves. But actually, that's exactly what we need for an organization. Otherwise, you don't get recognized. So you can, all of these motivations are important. No one motivator is better than the other, and a team needs all of them. Okay. Now, I'll pick up on something you said, because you said you had spirit and director. Spirit is freedom and autonomy. Director is control. So that might cause a battle in your brain around control and freedom. I want control, but I want freedom. And if you're a leader, the way that may show up is a Jekyll and Hyde type leadership. Some days it's the same issue dealt with different days, because sometimes you're in your controlling mood, director, and sometimes you're in your freedom mood where it doesn't matter. So that can confuse staff. And understanding that as a leader helps you understand your impact of your motivations on the workplace and on the people.
Thank you. The other thing I really struggle with is I'm really not a team player. Okay. What I mean by that is that I like to work independently. I count only on myself. And when I'm at work, I don't know you. Like, I'm working on a task. I'm completing this task. If I have to talk to you to tell you what you need to do, then I will. But I don't play around. Like, I don't socialize. Like, I don't do any like nice talk about weather, or I don't waste time. But after work, you can come with me to the pub or wherever, and I will be the funniest person that you know. But during work time, like, I'm very serious. Like, I don't know you, right? Like, I have to complete a task.
Yeah. So these are work motivators. It's a really good point you make there. So all of this identifies your lowest there. Your lowest is friend. So anybody engaging in idle chit chat that has no purpose or meaning in the workplace is going to get short shift, because actually you've got no time for it, especially as you've got spirit really high. You value your independence. So anybody trying to talk to you about anything that's not work-related is going to get short shift, basically. They're going to get a flea in their ear and told to get lost, probably, in a polite way. But you haven't got time for them, because your freedom is really important. And because your friend is really low, which is socializing in the workplace, and your spirit is really high, which is independence, it magnifies your desire for freedom. So it makes you even more independent. So people... approaching. So what you need to learn, if you're a manager, you need to learn to build a bit of social time, even though you wouldn't like it, just to appease those people who like it.
Thank you. And the other thing that I really struggle with, like, I trigger people, because like, I think I am very intimidating, and I'm not aiming to. Like, for example, if you met me at a networking event, like, I'm the friendliest person, the funniest person you may know. But at work, when it comes to like doing a task, I am very, very serious, very, very committed. And I am looking at the time, like how long it took me to do it, how many whatever I did, you know, like I have to complete the task. Yeah. That's the thing I'm focusing on. So like, how can someone like me, like, unlock employee engagement and motivation when I have people working for me where I am like this, like this is how I am?
Okay, so that's the whole point of doing the motivational match as a team. So we look at a team and go, right, okay, we work out very quickly. Lily likes her freedom. I like to chat to Lily. I can understand now why Lily behaves like she does. Okay, and Lily's going to say to the employee, look, I understand you need a bit of social time, so here's the deal. I'm focused. When I finish this, I'll come and find you and I'll give you 5 minutes. Okay. So it's because they don't understand why you're like that, that it causes friction. Once they understand that spirit's so important to you, the freedom piece is so important to you, that you need to get a task done. Once they understand that, they'll just go, oh, Lily's in space now. We better leave her alone. And when she comes out, she'll let us know and we'll have a chat. So what this does, it creates understanding with teams rather than conflict.
Thank you. So how can teams in general resolve conflict and understand each other and accept themselves better? Is it that they have to do some sort of training course to understand each other's motivation style, or what do they need to do?
Okay, so the way I do this in several ways. So I do a half day team building day with this. So we look at the employee engagement wheel like we've just been through, and then we look at everybody to do their motivations, then we get everybody together as a team and go, right, let's understand each other. And you have got conflicting motivations, as you've rightly said. So you've got the spirit and the director conflicting each other. You've also got the defender, who likes security and predictability, frightened to death by the creator, who loves to innovate all day long. So the innovator is usually the business owner, the defender is usually the accountant. So the business owner's got all these crazy ideas. he lands it on the defender, and the defender goes, whoa, you know, we're not doing that because of X, Y, Z. He will bust the company. But then they create understanding. So I'm the innovator. I'm going to give it to the defender, who's the bean counter or the person who controls the finances. Right, you're going to tell me why it's not going to work. And then so they become a foil for each other. So rather than being at loggerheads because they don't understand each other, suddenly they become a foil for each other and they come up with a sensible solution. So you can kind of see straight away, when you do this as a team, is when people understand why people behave around the motivations the way they behave, and they understand why they come to work and what they're looking for, it takes away all the conflict and creates a synergetic environment where I now understand I need to have a chat with you. I now understand Lily needs her space. I now understand this person needs to innovate. I now understand this person actually needs to be on stage shouting about it, and I don't like that type of thing. So it creates understanding where previously there was misunderstanding and conflict.
Thank you. Tell us some case studies where you unlocked employee engagement and motivation for certain companies, and what kind of things were they suffering from?
Okay, yeah. So I've worked with many companies, so it's really, really interesting. So what I do is I put a motivational action planning process in their organization. So I train key people in the organization to run the appraisal process. I supply them with the motivational maps monthly. We do it once every 90 days. So you do 90 days KPI for your business. You don't do it for your people. Let's do it for your people. And this way, we'll stop talent leaving. I'll give you some examples of talent potentially leaving in a second. And also, we're keeping abreast of actually, because motivation is dynamic and changeable. So let me give you an example. I had a guy that was, he was in a cohort of business owners that met once a month. And they'd been meeting for 2 years. And we got everybody to guess each other's motivations for a bit of fun. And they couldn't guess this one guy's motivation. They thought he was a creator, which is an innovator. They thought he was a spirit, which is a free spirit. And they thought he was a searcher adding value. He said, no, I'm a defender right now. And then they were completely perplexed by this. They just couldn't get their heads around it. He said, well, let me explain. My life circumstances right now, I'm going through a very expensive divorce. It's costing me a lot of money. It's impacting my business. And I'm trying to actually secure myself as I go through the divorce. And it was pre-Brexit in the UK, so he couldn't even buy a house. So he was all about security and predictability because of his circumstances. And this is all based on Maslow, a lot of this stuff. So one need gets met, another one comes in. So if you've got someone whose husband or wife loses their job, suddenly it's security for them. If you've got kids at university and suddenly they're through and out the other end, suddenly it's not about security now, it's about freedom. So your motivation's changing all the time. So we need to identify that. Because otherwise we're going to lose people as we go through the journey. So I did it with a law firm with 170 staff. We looked at all their people. We identified 5 people who were at risk of leaving because their motivations weren't being harnessed by the organization. They were key fee earners. And when I spoke to the managing partner, I said, so he drove around and sat with each of them once he knew their motivations and put this right and re-engaged them. And I said, what would that have costed you if they had left the organization? He reckoned it was about £1 million in, because they would have taken clients. It would have been difficult to replacement. There would have been problems with clients. So it's interesting you say, you know, how do we work with this? I teach people how to use it in the organization so they understand it, so they understand how to harness that person's motivation and how to get out of their way a lot of the time. I don't know if that answered your question.
Yes, it does. Tell me more about how does the company's mission or vision, how does that impact a person's willingness to stay with a company for the long term? Like, I don't know, I'm not sure if people stay 20 years anymore, but like 5 years or something, and stay like engaged and motivated with a certain company for 5 years, let's say.
Okay, so that's why we do the wheel first, and we look at the vision and the story, and the story and the vision play a massive part in this. So you must have come across the expression that what's the expression? Culture eats strategy for breakfast. That's the expression we hear quite a lot, but people don't really understand what that means. So when we talk about culture, let me just say this: you could have the best strategy in the world that the company's designed, but if the people aren't willing to go on the journey, aren't motivated to go on the journey, it doesn't actually matter. okay? If you have a great culture where people join the organization because they believe in the organization, the story's great, they can see why the company exists, what it's trying to achieve and where it's trying to go, then you design your strategy, people will follow the strategy. That makes sense. So the story, people love stories. People love being, you know, they love a cause. You talked about searcher wanting to make a difference. But when a company's got a vision and a story about what they want to achieve, that's how people can see that and how they can hook in and they can see how they can make a difference. If it's just a cold strategy, which is numbers, it's not the same.
Thank you. One that Apple can ruin a company's culture. So how can companies unlock employee engagement and motivation where a new hire is starting to trigger everybody, which I'm sure if it was me, like a new hire, I'm certain that I would trigger almost everybody. And it would not take me more than an hour to do it.
Yeah. Okay. So, well, first of all, it's about the recruitment, first of all. That will be the first thing. Let's make sure we're hiring Lily for the right reasons, not the wrong reasons. Okay. Secondly, is Lily a fit? So one of the things that I try to encourage companies to do is to look at their recruitment and look at it like this. So let me explain through my Fitness First days. When I was recruiting in Fitness First, we had the pick of the bunch of people coming out of colleges and university in their droves. So it wasn't necessarily about skill. It was about attitude and behavior. Okay. So I was looking for different things. I was looking for a receptionist that could make eye contact within 30 seconds of someone walking into the building. I wanted them to answer the phone within three rings so we didn't lose the sales inquiry. And I wanted them to get in the sales inquiry to the salesperson within 10 minutes so we definitely didn't lose the person to another company. In the actual gym itself, we were employing 16 and 17-year-olds. If we left them to their own devices, they would just talk to their colleagues, their buddies the same age. So we were looking for people who could talk to old age pensioners, maybe a timid lady coming back after pregnancy. We were looking for different attitudes and skills over and above the ability to show them how to use equipment. In the aerobic studio, I didn't want boring people who just went through the routine. I wanted entertainers. I wanted people who could make people forget their miserable day. So I was looking for attitudes and behaviors. And the way that I developed that was I developed a list of A, B, C. If you think about someone who's outstanding at doing a job, over and above the skill sets required to do the job, what makes them special? It's being proactive, easy to follow, a good leader, creative, thinking outside the box. Now, if you take that to, let's say, a plumber, when a plumber goes to do a job at a house, you can get someone who goes in, does the job, leaves a mess, doesn't speak to anybody. Okay, technically good, it's done the job. Or you can get a plumber that goes in, engages with the family, fixes the problem, tidies up, and actually makes some recommendations on things they could do. Okay, that's attitude and behavior versus just skill. So we make a list and then we go, okay, these are the attitudes I want to see, and these are the attitudes I want to recruit for in my organization. And you have a B list, which is people we could develop into an A player, and we have a C list, we'd never employ them. So we work out exactly what we want, skill-wise and attitudinal-wise, and they would have, and they might have picked up with you, Lily, that actually, you know, you don't like talking to people because you like to get the job done. Now, this is a job that requires task and it requires someone to work on their own, so that's perfectly okay. Let me explain that to the rest of the team. Let the team understand that, yeah, you are going to piss them off, but actually we need you in that role because you are brilliant and very focused, okay? So what comes with Lily is actually, yeah, she's not going to engage with you. You're going to slightly piss her off because you don't understand her. Understand, if you understand her, and let's make sure the team understands you when you come in, that problem goes away. Okay? That makes sense?
Yes, it makes a lot of sense. Now, for example, for me, I find I have some adaptability. So for example, let's say when I used to work as a babysitter and cleaner, I was talking to the clients before starting and at the end, but I would like be very focused on finishing the job first.
Yeah.
So like what I thought was I was doing what I thought was important, which is actually completing the job in the fastest best way possible. And that's not to say that I wasn't like friendly. I was always friendly, but I was just like focused on the job. And let's say if I was to do like some sort of, if I was to be like a hostess for an event or like a receptionist, then I would be friendly because that would be the role. That would be the
yeah,
top.
That'd be the, yeah, that'd be,
you
the
know
requirement.
what I mean?
So, yeah, so it's, so I think it's just about preempting. If you said to someone, look, I'm very task orientated typically, so I'll be focused on the task, you might find that a bit abrupt or rude. It's not intentional. That's just the way I operate. Please come and ask me a question. But if you feel I'm a bit curt, just tell me, because I'm not intending to be that way. So it's just about preempting it so people know, you know, actually, yeah, I can understand you need to get the job and you're on a tight schedule. I'll leave you in peace. Because the last thing you want to do is, you know, it's a plumber with your makeup going in and someone trying to make them a cup of tea and talk to them all day long when they're trying to get a job done and they're working on the clock. So it's just a case of setting the boundaries and the rules straight away, explaining how you operate so people understand and they understand how to behave around you. Okay. And it's not rudeness. It's just, I'm going to get the task done. I'm very task orientated. Okay. And then I am adaptable. If I'm front of house, then yeah, I'm going to be that networker. I'm going to be social because that's the task.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now tell me about, what are some other case studies where you unlocked employee engagement and motivation for different companies, and what kind of problems did they suffer from?
Okay, so I did a team once that were, they were local authority business advisors, and they were on a contract, and they were coming to the end of a contract, so they were all scared about where they were going to go next, so their motivations were all low. And the manager had another 6 months for these people before they moved on or possibly got taken back on. So there was a bit, so there was a lot of uncertainty. Most of them were employees, so they had defender profile quite high, which is security and predictability. And she was trying to grapple with how does she manage them. So it was very clear to her after we did this, to manage that team properly, she needs to reassure them as best she can about their future. So she changed her whole approach and started to work out how she could get them jobs, how she could help them look for new work should it come up, how she could get them to express their concerns to her. And that enabled them to finish the contract on a high while she fully supported them in looking and helping them find new work. And I'm not sure that's a good example, but that's one example.
Thank you. Tell us some of the worst case studies that you've seen in terms of trying to get employees engaged and it not working or working completely the opposite way.
Okay, that doesn't happen to me very often because the companies that, okay, let me frame this differently. I get told, can you go and work with this company? Can you go and work with that company all the time? Now, if I walked in their door and said, look, let's look at the motivations of your staff, they go get lost because actually it's all about output and we don't really care about our staff. We've got high churn. So I don't get invited into those organizations typically. I get invited into organizations that are trying to do this, grappling with it, but struggling. Now, I'll give you an example. One of the examples in the Mapping Motivation for Engagement book was a large defense industry contract company. So they were about 16 and a half million turnover, I think, when I took them. They had 200 staff, but they were a second generation business. So the father had handed over to the son. The son wanted to get employee engagement right. So we had old school, new school. We had people who liked it like it was, and people who, and then the new son wanted to generate employee engagement. So we had the board and the senior management team. I worked with them for a year. We lost one of the board members because they wouldn't play the game, but we had to get agreement at the very top level that we were going to all agree the vision for the organization, the story, and everybody was going to stand behind it. Because if they didn't demonstrate it, how can we get the staff to demonstrate it? We still had the father of that business dropping in and meddling because he was bored. Now he'd left, but he came back and kept meddling and causing problems. So we had to eliminate him from the equation by taking him out. And then we ended up with a business that slowly moved from the mix match of old school, new school to a cohesive environment. And it takes a bit of work and it takes a lot of energy and it takes a lot of the manager's coaching and doing the right things and demonstrating best practice consistently. And the way that you change that organization is you don't tolerate poor performance, you don't tolerate poor values being expressed. You pick up on that straight away. You put people right. You set performance criteria clear. You listen to staff and you engage with them to get them to perform at the level you want. I don't know if that makes sense.
How can companies heal relationships that have already been severed or have been, let's say, led to conflict or have led to people's feelings being hurt? How can they heal those relationships so they can engage the employees again after they are already disengaged and perhaps demotivated and already thinking about leaving the company?
Yeah, so that's a really great question, Lenny. And I see that quite a bit. I've got a law firm currently that's the engagement's waning. It's quite obvious it's waning. They don't walk the talk at all. So the only way to address that is to sit down the senior leadership team, the board, and say, look, you're either serious about doing this or you're not. If you're not, so I had this in a company I worked with a few years back. It was a law firm. And the way that because law firms think in money, they don't think in people. They think in money and they're technically good. And they've got all sorts of problems in their organizations where the fee earners think they're better than the people who do the back office stuff, etc. We earn all the money, you spend it, all that kind of stuff. So there's a lot of ego in there. So we had to sit down and go, right, you've got to actually create an environment where everybody's behind it. Everybody believes in it, and you have to hold people accountable. And it's not easy. And sometimes people leave, and it's the right thing because they're not the right fit. The second thing is they were struggling to get youngsters to stay with them because they were onboarding them, seeing the mess. They weren't engaged with the organization and they were leaving. So the way that we got around this was I identified that they'd lost well over £1 million in turnover in staff in a year. And as soon as I pointed out that £1 million plus of staff have walked out of their business because they were mismanaging, I got their attention. So you had to speak their language a little bit first.
Thank you. How can companies that pretend to have a good mission and vision, but internally do something completely different, like companies that pretend to be green and they're really just greenwashing, they're just pretending to be into green stuff and recycling and so on, and actually internally they are not respecting that at all. They're just doing it for the brand, you know, perception. Yeah. The one.
Yeah.
And how can they still retain employees?
Right. Well, that comes back to their integrity. They're not going to attract the right employees, because if they've got a set of values which they don't live up to, and they won't live up to the values if they're saying one thing and doing another. So first of all, they'll struggle to get staff, because a lot of young staff now won't join an organization unless they live up to the values. So they'll either join and leave very quickly, or they won't join at all. If they're telling a story, they need to sit behind it. So typically, if you have any say do that, so if we say one thing and we do another, that means there's no integrity in that organization. And it means that there isn't a way back for them. They'll just churn staff.
Thank you. What values should a company adhere to that you consider essential for unlocking employee engagement and motivation?
Yeah, well, seeing employees as an asset, not a problem, first of all, because often companies see just staff as a problem. So seeing staff as an asset, not a problem. Understanding that staff drive the business. So if you enhance, so the quality of the people you employ is the quality of the output. Making people central to decision-making. That drives employee engagement. I would be looking for an organization to back fully the employee engagement of an organization. I would get them to look at their staff turnover, their sickness levels. In the UK, it's only 10% of employees going to work are actually engaged, according to Gallup. So there's how many people are underperforming in the organization because they're not engaged. I'd get them to look at that. Sickness is really interesting, because the average The average sickness of a good employee is about 3 days per year. On average, it's 7 days in private sector in the UK and 17 days in the public sector. Now, it costs a company £750 per month, per employee per day, sorry, for lost productivity. So in sickness, so in lost productivity and sickness cover. So just 10 days is going to cost them £7,500 if they're not careful. And then if you multiply that through the workforce, that's a lot of money walking out the door through sickness, absenteeism, stress, etc. If you're managing motivation well, people won't be going sick so much. They won't be stressed. And they'll not only not be doing that, but they'll be actively giving discretionary effort. So it's a case sometimes of boiling it down to hard facts and numbers. Sickness levels is one. Absenteeism is another. Lost productivity. Those are the key things. And then looking at, well, are we carrying people in our organization? Because if only 10% of people going to work are engaged, how much lack of productivity is actually happening in your organization? And who are the people who are hiding in your organization that you're not detecting?
Thank you. So, what other measures can companies put in place to increase productivity?
Well, I put the motivational action planning in place. So we do that. We train staff in that. You can do, I don't really like engagement surveys because they tend to be historical. So you look at it, and if a company doesn't act on it, well, it's no point. You're getting feedback from staff, you're not acting on it. So if you're going to do employee engagement surveys, act on it. You don't want to do an employee engagement survey every year because people don't want to wait a whole year to express how dissatisfied or satisfied they are. So you can do quarterly satisfaction surveys. You could do a lot to, once you understand the motivations, you can do a lot to actually, because every motivation I've described has a different way of rewarding it. So there are different, you know, some people want a bit of time with their children, a bit of flexi time. Other people want money. Other people want a bit of freedom. Other people want more creativity. Other people want learning opportunities. So understanding what it is that people really want versus actually just deciding you're going to give them pay or a pay rise. The trouble with pay rises is people expect a pay rise. They expect a bonus. And it doesn't. And if you don't give them a pay rise or a bonus, it creates a negative impact in the organization. So what you're trying to do is work out. So if you get paid a bonus this year, but next year you don't get paid a bonus, that's a negative. Okay. It's a demotivator. So, and pay is a short-term reward. Anyway, people soon get used to a new pay and then it doesn't no longer motivates them. So we should move away from pay and looking at how do these staff really want to be rewarded? It could be you do cinema tickets. It could be you do days off, duvet days, you know, acknowledging their good work. It's all kinds of things related to their motivations that really actually show up for them that they like.
Thank you. Any last message that you have, or otherwise tell us where entrepreneurs and companies can connect with you?
Okay. So it's probably best through LinkedIn because we're doing this. I guess this goes out LinkedIn, does it? I don't know how it goes out. Yeah. It's probably best through LinkedIn. I've got a website, which is on my LinkedIn as well, www.skillsforbusinesstraining.co.uk. And I've got an even longer email, which is steve@skillsforbusinesstraining.co.uk. All my details pretty much sit on my LinkedIn or my website. And there's some quizzes on my website you can take as well if you want to engage with me. But please probably either email me or contact me through LinkedIn, I think is the easiest thing.
Thank you. Follow me for more interviews with world's most innovative health change makers to live your healthiest life ever.